There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Simon Whittle texts the ticket on 4001 and he said, "Hello, Steph, I would rather be stuck in Manchester rather than Newcastle. Just saying." And she said, "Whatever, Simon Whittle." Anyway, welcome along. It's going to be our last ever radio book club coming up very shortly. It's going to be an amazing one. Stay tuned for that. Mark Lloyd, if you're missing him, my usual partner in crime, he's on holiday right now. He's in the Philippines, but he is coming back with a new project in place of the ticket.
It's called Sounds of the Summer, and it's your chance to dictate the songs you want to hear on the radio. So when you get a minute, jump online, get to DubaiEye1038.com, and you can take part in a quick music survey. In return for that, you can get the chance to win a really great prize. We have a free holiday for four to Sicily to give away.
DubaiEye1038.com. Take part in that survey. You got to be in it to win it. And Mark Lloyd will be back in July. Your afternoons are going to be filled with music, entertainment, and everything you need to know about what's happening in the UAE.
Right now, it's showtime.
We got a couple of bits of book news in Radio Book Club that we would like your input on. You can get in touch with the show on 4001. You can also use the free Dubai Eye app. You can also get us on Facebook as well, actually, or on Twitter at DubaiEye1038FM. You can also find me at Off Air Steph. Our Clan Baluki is here. It can only mean one thing.
The Radio Book Club. Members only.
You ready for this, or are you feeling a bit emotional?
I'm ready, but I am feeling emotional, Steph. Aww. I can't believe you're not going to be here anymore.
With social media, though, I feel like it's so much easier to leave anywhere.
I know. You got to be posting a lot from your caravan. And
you're going to be sick of me. Totally sick of me. So starting off with a little bit of book news this week, and a bit of a random one. I read this article, and it wasn't really about this, but something that he said in his article just really stood out to me. So as someone who was reading two books at the same time, so he was like, I'll read 10 to 15 pages of this, and then I'll read 10 to 15 pages of the other one, and then I would jump back again. And I was like, nobody does this. That's a weird way to read, isn't it?
I do that.
What?
Yeah, I do. Sometimes I can't wait to start another book that I've got that I really, really want to read as well. And I think it works if it's two very different books, like if I'm reading a historical fiction and then, you know, a fictional novel might go well together, or if it's a children's book and, you know, I don't know, a book on religion or something.
I thought there was a law against this. I really did. I just thought you have a book, you read it all, you get involved. And then you move on to the next one.
Yeah, I'm like you, Steph. I can't even process the idea of two books at the same time. But what's even worse about this is 10 to 15 pages at a time. So does that mean if he's down, you know, doing one sitting at a cafe reading his book, he's got two with him there and he just sort of switches back and forth?
No, not in one setting.
You wouldn't think.
No, I wouldn't do it in one setting.
So you do have rules when it comes to this. So let's say before bed, you would never read two books before bed.
No, not at the same setting, no.
Okay.
I'd read one and then maybe the next night I might, depending on how I feel.
So it can't be the same day is what you're saying?
It can be the same day.
Huh. How long are we in between?
Maybe in the afternoon and then the evening or in the morning. It depends, you know. And then if one book turns out to be so much more exciting than the other that you can't wait, then you'll finish this one and then go back to the other one. I wouldn't put rules to say 15 pages here and 15 pages there. But, you know, if you think about it, when you're in university, you're constantly studying multiple books at the same time, right? Or if even the way that we consume data online or we read different things all the time. So why couldn't you do it with a book?
It doesn't feel right.
And I think, like, maybe fiction and nonfiction, but if it was just fiction, like two fiction books at the same time, you get so immersed in the story and the characters.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden to switch to another one that just
then
feels
it's
confusing.
Overwhelming, I think.
Can you imagine trying to read Girl on a Train and Gone Girl at the same time?
No, that's too much. But that's already giving you what you want. Like the one book is giving you, it's like satisfying that part of you that wants to read that type of book. So why would you read two?
Well, what if they're the only books that you like? Oh, biographies. Yeah. Imagine having two biographies on the go. You'd be confused about what Phil Collins did.
Yeah, that's a bit much. I think you couldn't do that. I couldn't do that.
Hey, let us know if anyone does this, if they read two books at the same time, because I've got a feeling that Aklan might be the only person in Dubai. I'm just putting it out there.
Well, Shruti has already texted in to say, I do that too. One for daytime, one for night.
She's naughty. She would just be texting her in if she didn't anyway, just to be controversial. So there's that we wanted to talk about. 4001 if you want to text us today. Also, we wanted to talk about books, people not buying books anymore, because something's happened in Germany. A German study, the results have been released just last week, says that there has been a dramatic decline in book readership because more time is being spent online. Now, that when you say that out loud, it makes sense, right? We are spending a lot more time online. Like, when do you find time to read?
Are people buying less print books or e-books as well?
This is generally print books, but the e-books are also on the way down. Mm-hmm. The e-books are on the way down because people are turning back to print, but the print books are also down. So the number of people buying books in Germany, this study was done, plummeted by nearly 18% between 2013 and last year.
Yeah.
The drop was even steeper at 24 to 37% amongst the people who were aged 20 to 50, which is quite a large range. The same group that now spends more than 3 hours a day on the internet. So they're saying things like Netflix with binge-worthy television series. Mm-hmm. Frequently replace books as a pastime. So whereas you would go to bed and read a book, you're like, I'll just squeeze in one more hour of this show.
Yeah, and you know, that is the sad reality. I think people are spending a lot more of their time, you know, on Netflix and online, and that's why the job of organizations like the Literature Foundation comes in, you know, and any community literature festival comes in, and you know, we have a hard job to do because we need to keep reminding people that it's a completely different experience, what the results of reading for children is when they grow up, and you know, what it can add to your life, because I think a lot of people will take the easy way out, and if something is summarized into a minute of your time, why would you give it an hour? And it's just the way that people are, you know, perceive it. But I think, yeah, from the relationships that we have with publishers abroad, and this conversation comes up every year at the festival, and I think there was a decline, but they're seeing an incline again in physical books. You know, a lot of it, I think, it's not purely based on reading or not reading. It could be to do with, you know, saving trees and not wanting to buy print copies or not buying paper. But now, you know, there's a lot of ways of reading on print books responsibly, because there's books that will have, you know, the sign in the back which says this has come from a sustainable forest, for example, and things like that. So
there's a big thing about getting kids involved in books, I think, because if you learn to read as a child, you're always going to love it. If you learn to love it as a child.
Yeah.
And I think for kids, it can be very easy for parents to say, oh, go online, entertain yourself. Like, you've really got to encourage them to read and sometimes read with them.
Yeah.
And I heard the most horrendous story on a radio station called LBC yesterday. I was listening to it while I was making dinner. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about a 9-year-old girl who was so addicted to being online, playing computer games, that she wet herself rather than going to the bathroom. She made a conscious decision that I would rather do this than get out of the league that I'm in.
Yeah.
And then attacked her dad because he's like, what are you doing? She's like, no, this is really important. And I think you've got to introduce kids to books so that they don't get so entangled in online life.
It's kind of like they're hypnotized, isn't it?
Too much
of it.
And it's tough in an age where all kids have an iPad. Mm-hmm. You know, because I'm thinking about when I was 8 or 9 years old, my mom would check out books from the library for me, and that's what I would do after school.
Yeah.
But now I think it's just so easy to have that iPad handy.
Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, parents have got to be a little bit clever in the way that they introduce books to them. Like, if parents don't read at all and they're constantly, you know, telling their kids to read, they learn by what they watch, not necessarily what you tell them. But also pay attention to what your kid likes. What are they interested in and what are they curious about? And, you know, then recommend books to them about the subjects that they like, even if it's about gaming, even if it's about something that is, you know, not of your own interest, but think about their own mind and try to always encourage curiosity in them, because if they're curious, they'll always go out and find answers, and that's what you want.
It's good advice. That's why we have you on the show. And you're not alone. Tony has also texted on 4001 and says, I read more than one book at a time. Definitely depends on my mood. So there are two, possibly three of you in Dubai that do this.
Good job, Tony. Thanks for backing me up.
We're going to come into books proper in a second. We've got a travel book that is going to inspire you, but it's also going to make you sad at the same time because we actually lost the author of this book over the weekend.
The Ticket, also scientifically proven when listening to at 65 decibels to drown out the sound of the school run in the back seat. The Ticket
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to The Ticket. Hope you're having a great Tuesday afternoon. Will you be having a great Tuesday? No, because it's a Monday. I hope you're having a great Monday afternoon. We're doing this.
The Radio Book Club. Members only.
I don't know what it is, but I was looking at the texts before on Tuesday and I'm like, there's none. And I'm like, of course there isn't any because that's tomorrow. I don't know why I think it's Tuesday. So we are looking at the Radio Book Club for the very last time this week. Ahlan Baluki is here with us. She is a festival director for the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature, doing a wonderful job. Nearly everyone is booked for next year.
Quite a few. A lot, yes, they are. It's very exciting, but I can't announce yet.
When is the festival next year?
March 1st to March 9th, and we'll be announcing the names in November.
Oh, I'll be back in November, so I'll find out.
Yeah,
awesome. And I think I'm going to come back for the festival as well.
Yeah, you have to.
It's one of my favourite things that happens in Dubai every single year. So, books, we've got a lot to get through today for all different kinds of travels. And we're going to start with a book that's going to inspire you to travel. It's also going to make you a little bit sad, though, this week.
Yeah, I'm sorry to make everyone sad, but Anthony Bourdain, we have to talk about him on this travel show.
We do. Should we start with a montage?
Yes, let's do it.
I moved from 44-year-old fry cook, basically, to whatever I do now, pretty much overnight, on the basis of a memoir where I pretty much fessed up to everything. So I'm an open book. I've never had a reputation to lose, which is a huge advantage. I didn't have to think about what people expected. Whatever we did last week, no matter how well it was received, how successful it was, how the ratings were, how much people loved it, whatever we're going to do next week, we want to try really, really hard to undermine completely what we did last week. We want to present a moving target.
In my worldview, food certainly plays a role, hopefully, in bringing some kind of enlightenment and understanding and openness and appreciation.
I loathe, in principle, the idea of adhering to any orthodoxy because my travels have shown me, as I move from place to place, that what I thought yesterday is, in fact, completely wrong again and again.
It's still really hard to believe that he's no longer here.
It is. He's one of those characters that just should be alive forever, and he will be through his videos and his shows and his books, and that voice is just so alive. And he was more than just a chef and a traveler. He wasn't afraid to step away from it and highlight more important matters from everywhere around the world. And it wasn't your typical traveler story. It wasn't your top things to do here and the best things about this and that. It was more about that feeling and letting you in on how it feels and what the people are and how does it smell here and, you know, what does it feel like being in that place. And he was one of the first, and he changed the game on food and travel. But also, he's someone who is just very real. You can tell he's not scripted when he talks. And I actually usually make notes on the books that I'm talking about on the show. I didn't make any notes about him because I can just talk about him for hours. Anthony Bourdain is someone who has been to my family's house. He shot the Dubai episode with my husband and his brother. The family met him. He spent the whole day in my in-law's house a couple of years ago, just, you know, having Emirati food, talking about the region, talking, you know, understanding, exchanging stories about families. And it's just very, very difficult for all of us to believe that he's gone. I actually have got a signed copy of No Reservations with me here today.
It's a really special memory.
Yeah. What did your family say about him, about that meeting? And, you know, what was the feeling after he had left that day?
So this was before I was married to my husband, and this was my husband's family. And his sister's my best friend. So, I was close to it and I heard all about it. And that's what, you know, they said, that he's someone who was exactly the same off camera as he was on camera. There was no act. There was not, you know, it was, if he was asking a question, he was genuinely curious about that topic. And, you know, he's just no fuss.
for who he is, you know. He's just very down to earth, humbled guy, and spent the whole day in the family. He was just very, very upset when we heard.
I think what he said there about not having a reputation to lose would bring you an amazing sense of freedom, wouldn't it? Yeah. Especially working in an industry where you are really judged.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really sad.
Yeah, it is. It is very sad. But the book that I've brought today by Anthony Bourdain is called No Reservation. And it's travel, but it's in the, you know, classic Bourdain way. It's not necessarily about the top places to visit. It's not only about food, although it has food in it. It's a book about 3 years of travel that he did on the show. And, you know, he covers all sorts of things. And it's, you know, he's not limited. You know, there's a section about, you know, food. And there's a section about what country has the best toilet and what country has the worst toilet. And what,
we got to be in there for best toilet, surely. Yeah.
It's true. It's such a big it's such a big hassle. And as an Arab, you know, we know this because the bidet situation around the world is a big issue for us. But, you know,
tell me about it. Having lived here for 13 years is one of the things that I'm going to miss the most. Like, I'm seriously looking into changing everything. I go back to England because I can't live without it.
Yeah, you need to. I think there's a portable one I found. Take it with you, Steph. Don't go on the road without it.
Amazing.
But yeah, you know, so he talks a lot about his team, and there's a lot of stories, and it's not structured in a certain way. You know, there's all sorts of pictures in here, and there's just like very genuine moments of all sorts of things. So yeah, relive Bourdain's travels through this book for sure.
Oh, I love it. Thank you for bringing that one in.
No, no problem.
And now moving from a travel book, which is sort of a cookbook, into an actual cookbook, you've got one for us that is going to take us on a journey across Morocco, Marrakesh, through the Sahara, onto the blustery shores of the Atlantic coast.
Yes. The book is called Orange Blossom and Honey by John Gregory Smith. And I absolutely adore Moroccan food, even though I've never been to Morocco. I really, really want to go. But so whenever I have guests and I haven't had time to cook for them, I don't want to order in something that feels ordered in. So I order in Moroccan food and it feels like I've spent the entire day making it.
Where do you order it from?
I order from this place called Kif Kif. They used to have a restaurant in Jumeirah. Unfortunately, they closed, but they still have one in Marina. It is so good. And every time I've ordered it, people think I've spent the whole day and actually cooked that thing. But it's really, really good.
And you never put them right?
No, I do. I do. It still tastes delicious, so no complaints. But if you want to go out and actually have a fancier Moroccan meal, I really recommend that you go to the Royal Mirage. They have a restaurant called Tajine there, and it's a really, really special special.
That's what I
experience.
Think of when I think of Moroccan food. I think of a tagine.
Yeah,
but I always think it looks really difficult to cook Moroccan food.
Well, it's the same as... So when you ask people, what's your comfort food? A lot of people will say roast, right? Mm-hmm. Because that kind of slow-cooked dish, it just... There's something so amazing about it. You know, you can smell it. It's comforting. And actually, it's not that... I mean, not that I'm an expert in making Moroccan food. I've actually tried once and I failed horribly. So maybe, yeah. But, you know, the recipes always look easy. But I think I put the honey in the wrong time. And I'd spent like 4 hours cooking. And then it actually, my lamb stuck to the bottom.
Oh, no.
And it went terribly wrong. So I need this book. But... you know, some of the best tagines, so they come in form of, if it's lamb, it's traditionally cooked with prunes or apricots. And if it's chicken, traditionally with lemon and olives. And the fish usually comes in a saffron-based sauce with almonds. So they're just absolutely divine. And some of the dishes from the book, harissa beef msemen. So msemen is a kind of traditional Moroccan pancake. Mm. And there's like a nice beef in it. There's a dish like this in most cuisines, but this is the traditional Moroccan ones. There's a boulfaf, which is the lamb liver kebabs, traditionally made in Eid, given Eid is coming up. Maybe, you know, people want to make this for their families. There's a quinton lamb tagine. There's a trout tagine. There's an amazing dessert.
A trout tagine.
Yes, and it looks so good. I wish I had the book here with me so that I could show you. But if you go online, you'll find it.
It's amazing. It's got all this herb and little slices of tomato and all sorts of spices on top. It looks amazing.
Yum.
You know what I love about tagine? When they have sort of a savory meat and then they have something a little bit sweet, like an apricot or something in there.
It's amazing.
So good.
And the textures are just so good. And the smell. Ugh.
Although that smell, when you've eaten too much of it, can really send you over the edge. I always find in a Moroccan restaurant, you've got to get out quick at the end.
In the end, you've got to have this dessert, which is the pomegranate and rose water millefeuille. Looks so, so good. And even though I'm not big on dessert, like, the book has this recipe and I need to try to make it.
John Gregory Smith, we've got a little clip of him talking about what makes Moroccan cuisine so special, as he is the author of this cookbook.
So Moroccan food is obviously North African food, and it's a lovely sort of blend of North African and Arabic influence. So you get really lovely layers of fragrance and spices and wonderful aromas within the cuisine. It's delicious. Obviously, like, the classic tagine is massive, and they do cook them all over the country. So the tagine is, you know, your conical shaped pot where you shove everything in, put the lid on and cook it, and it sort of steams and cooks slowly and beautifully. They also love couscous. They absolutely love it. And whereas we would just like shove some boiling water on it and then wait, like, and then eat it, they will massage couscous and oil it and spend hours making this lovely fluffy thing and then serve it with a stew. And it's like what they have on Fridays, which is the religious day, so the whole family will come around and eat couscous, and they just love it. Even when you talk to Moroccans about couscous, they'll start smiling. And then bread is really big, so loads of different bread, sweet, savoury, and then actually like a lot of vegetables and salads, so they've got quite a nice, diverse cuisine.
Stop it, John. Enough already. That does sound amazing. And I was just thinking there, would a tagine work good in the van when I'm travelling?
Do you have an oven?
Yeah, little one. Does the tagine have to go in the oven?
I think so. I think you can cook it on top of the stove as well, but I think traditionally it's in the oven. I think you could make it work.
You got to have the right pot, and then you'd be able to make it.
So Orange Blossom and Honey by John Gregory Smith is the cookbook that we are pointing you towards this week. Headlines are coming up now, and then we're going to be giving you a book for the plane. It is a number one New York Best Times seller. That doesn't sound right. What have I got wrong in that sentence? A number one New York Times bestseller. What have I got wrong? Just doesn't sound right.
You said New York Best Times seller.
Did I? Okay. And if you want to live till 100 years old, there is also a book that you desperately need. More on that next.
This is The Ticket.
Only on Dubai i103.8.
Welcome back to The Ticket. We'll be having a great Monday. You've joined us just in time for this.
The Radio Book Club. Members only.
Aklan Baluki is here from the Emirates Island Festival of Literature. She is the festival director. If you've got any questions, feel free. 4001, she's here for the next half an hour. And we're talking about books for all different kinds of travels. Picking up next with a book for the plane. This has got to be with me in mind.
That is for you.
What have you decided to go for?
Together?
I did say to you, do you think we could do death the whole way through murder? And you were like, don't know. But this is a murder one.
This is. I had to pick one murder at least. Well, actually, Bourdain, kind of.
Oh, sadly. Well, very, very sad. In fact, there has been a lot of, however, the cookbook is fine, unless we think about the lambs that are going in the tagine, I guess.
That's true. That's slaughter.
Although by the time we get to the kids' book, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Very rosy again.
It will be. Kind of.
Now, is this on a train? I feel like this is going to be on a train for some reason.
There is one train scene involved, so maybe that's what you're referring to. But okay, so the book is called The Death of Mrs. Westaway by Ruth Ware. Ruth, the author, is a British psychological crime thriller author. She's a New York Times bestseller. She's written The Woman in Cabin 10, if anyone's read that. And this is a new book, so published only 2 weeks ago, fresh in print. It's a part dramatic thriller, part murder mystery, part family drama. So it's a bit of everything. It's old-fashioned in that, you know, it's set in a dark and stormy night. And this girl who's only 21 years old is walking home on her own in the evening. Her name is Harriet Hall Westaway. And so she never knew the identity of her father, and her mother she lost her mother in a hit and run 3 years ago. And so she's on her own, and she does tarot card reading in a little resort town in England. And so she gets home that night, and she sees two letters that have arrived in the mail. One is a threat letter from a loan shark that she made a mistake of borrowing money from. And
yikes.
Yes. And the other one is a letter from a solicitor's firm in Cornwall informing Hall that of the death of her maternal grandmother and summoning her to read the will. Now, when she opens the will, she her eyes catch the words substantial size of the estate catch her eyes. And now the thing is, she knows that her maternal grandmother has died decades ago. So she...
Mistaken identity.
And she says, well, you know what? I have the skill because I do tarot card reading. I can actually read people really quickly the second I lay eyes on them. So why don't I try to actually go to the funeral, go to Cornwall.
No.
And just try to...
claim the money.
Yeah, commit like a big... you know,
kind of a fraud. Would
yeah,
you
kind
do
of
this?
A fraud. Of course not.
Me neither.
So no. No.
Bet you would.
But Hal is desperate right now because she's borrowed money from a loan shark who's threatening her and is apparently very dangerous. And
almost sounds like you're defending her.
I have to talk about both sides. And so she's like, okay, well, if I'm caught in the fraud act, I'm going to go straight to prison. But if I'm not, I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to get all this money. But as soon as she arrives there, certain things happen which make her think that maybe she's the one who's being conned into a fatal trap.
Oh.
And there's a very interesting turn of events, but
a
I won't say
twist.
Anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder who's out to get her.
I know.
A lot of the reviews that I've read about this say that it is really an old-fashioned murder mystery. It feels really old-fashioned, but...
yeah.
Exciting.
Mm-hmm. They use like weather references a lot to reflect the mood and what's happening next.
I like it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that is our suggestion for On the Plane, The Death of Mrs. Westaway by Ruth Ware. And when it comes to her influences, it may be old-fashioned for a reason. Take a little listen. Here's Ruth.
I was a huge classic crime geek as a teenager, and I read Agatha Christie, Josephine Tay, Dorothy L. Sayers, all of greats. I didn't really deliberately channel it when I was writing my first book in a dot dot wood, but as soon as I handed it to my agent, literally the first thing she said to me was, it's very Agatha Christie-ish. And when the reviews came out, people started to say the same thing. It's kind of a locked room mystery. So it definitely does. It has those kind of Christie-ish tropes. Even the title is taken from a nursery rhyme, which, you know, she does brilliantly in so many of her books. And when I was editing, I put in a little reference to And Then There Were None, I guess as a kind of thank you to her in a way of acknowledging her influence. So although it wasn't deliberate, I think she was there in my subconscious all along.
That's Ruth Ware there talking about her influences when she wrote The Death of Mrs. Westaway. Mm. And it's her fourth book, isn't it?
Yeah. Steph, maybe you're going to write a book on your road trip.
Think so?
Mm-hmm.
I might have enough time. My husband actually said to me the other day, he went, have you thought of anything to do? And I was like, what do you mean do? And he went, just, you know, you're not going to have like a platform for expression anymore. And I was like, it's fine. I'm sure I'll think of something to do on the way when I'm bored. That's a New York number one. Oh my gosh, what is wrong with me?
New York Times bestseller.
That's exactly what I said. So moving on to a book for after work. Something to relax whilst you're reading. However, I think reading this would make me panic about the future. It hasn't made you panic thinking about this?
I'd like to think I'm still young enough to make a change.
You are. Ikigai.
Ikigai. The
what
Japanese,
a great word.
Yes, the Japanese secret to a long and happy life. And, you know, there's so much to be learned from the Japanese. We just need to copy everything that they do and we'll be just fine.
Right?
Yes.
Japanese toilets. I don't know why that isn't everywhere.
I know.
We were talking about bidets earlier. Mm-hmm.
Even Bourdain ranked them number one.
Yeah.
Really? So. Number one?
Yes.
Okay.
Number one in the world.
Maybe we have something to learn in Dubai. I've never used Japanese toilets, so I don't know.
Really?
I'm kind of happy at my Dubai level, to be honest.
No, it's very sophisticated.
Oh.
Yeah, there's music. There's all sorts of things.
Bizarre. Okay. So Ikigai.
Ikigai.
All about having a happy life.
Yes, and it's the idea that having a purpose in life is key to happiness, or happiness is just always being busy. And what the two authors have done. So the authors are
Francesc Millares, I think that's how you pronounce his name. He's a essayist, translator, and musician, as well as Hector Garcia, who was a software engineer. And what the two of them have done was they focused on the village of Ogimi in Okinawa in Japan, that has the highest life expectancy anywhere in the world. And what they've done is they've just spoken to older people and studied some of their eating habits, their physical activities. You know, they monitor how they get together in the neighborhood, and they have tight relationships with friends, even at a very old age. And they've looked at a group of, here's your word for the week, super centenarians.
Yes.
Age 110 and above. And, you know, they've asked them all sorts of questions and, had looked at how they've lived their life. Now, there's different reviews on the book. There's people who say, well, there's actually no scientific proof that all of those things gives you a long life.
They got to be doing something, right?
Yeah, but there's things to be learned. I mean, you never know anyway, right, in life. But if you can take some tips and try them, why not?
Exactly.
What's the worst that could happen?
I mean, isn't it the case of like saying you're better off eating a lettuce than a chocolate bar?
That's true.
There are some things that are obviously going to be better in life for you.
That's yeah, true. The whole concept is so interesting, but it seems a bit vague to me. I couldn't quite place what does this mean.
So, ikigai.
To live with purpose. But what exactly does that look like?
The art of doing something and doing it with supreme focus and joy. I live with a little ikigai at home. She's constantly doing something. She was painting at about 10 o'clock last night.
Oh, wow.
Outside, painting palettes for the garden area. I went out and all of her mascara had like ran down her face. She was like, I did it. Constantly doing something. One of those people that makes you feel lazy for sitting down.
Yeah. So I think that's just a difference, right? Caring enough about something to constantly, repetitively come and do it and do it. Or if you're not doing that, then you're actively doing something else. And actually, there's a couple of things in the book like... you know, they have diagrams of basic Tai Chi or some yoga exercises that you could do, or just, you know, general advice about the type of vegetables to eat, or the type of, what makes relationships a key element in a long life and things like that. So
I found two other Japanese words that lead to a happier life. Mm-hmm. Are you keen to know them?
Yes.
Yes, please. Let's hear them. Okay. The first one is harahachibu. One of the most common sayings in Japan. They repeat it before or after eating meals in Japan, and it means fill your belly to 80%. That you should never, ever be 100% full, because if you are 100% full, then when it breaks down, the digestive process accelerates cellular oxidation.
Oh, wow.
Which mustn't be good. I'm taking it from that sentence.
I've heard something else culturally as well, is that Japanese don't finish their whole bowl, especially when they're served by someone else, to show respect to the person that served them, that in that the food was plenty.
Wish I'd known that the other night when I went out for Japanese food. The other word is moai, and that is an informal group of people with common interests who look out for one another. Mm. And for many, serving the community becomes a part of their ikigai.
Wow.
And the moai has its origins in hard times. So the farmers would get together to share how they were doing things when times were tough, and also help one another with harvests if they had like a really meager harvest. But the members of a moai, they set monthly contributions, money-wise, into the group. And then that allows them to have meetings, dinners, and games together, often Japanese chess, or whatever other hobbies they have in common. So it's all about being social.
I love that. And that makes so much sense, because we know so much of our happiness comes from connection and community.
Yeah,
that's true.
We have someone giving us an example, someone from Japan, who explains how she incorporates ikigai in her own life.
At that time, I was going to study other subject, and I thought I would not be able to do the other subject 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But I thought, okay, if it's a pottery, I would like to do it every day, 7 days a week, and long hours in a day. And in order to do that, it has to become my occupation. And even after 14, 15 years, I am still learning. That's the amazing thing about pottery. It brings me a lot of pleasure discovering things. And I'm very happy that my pottery is my job. And
So she made her job, she made her hobby her job, which is her ikigai.
That's amazing. I heard another example when I was researching for this book, and there's a lady who said, working for others is hard. Working for my garden is easier, so I just take care of my garden all day, every day.
There's something to that focus. I feel like now we're trying to do everything.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely. We have there's all these ideas. And
spreading
you feel
yourself
like,
too thin.
Yeah, and you feel like to be fulfilled, you've got to do everything. You know, there's always a bucket list. There's always things that you must do before you die. But actually,
I'm all about doing less.
Yeah.
I love it. I love just pottering around on a weekend. People will say, don't you feel like you're wasting your weekend? I'm like, nah, it's not a waste because I'm just enjoying doing nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I found my piece of that. So this book, Ikigai, The Japanese Secret to a Long and Happy Life, if you want to find it, it's by Francesc Milares. Mm-hmm. Is that what we're going with? Mm-hmm. And Hector Garcia as well. And we're going to have some more books for you when we come back. We are going to have one for the children because they need to travel too in the summer, and also a podcast for you. Don't go anywhere.
The Radio Book Club. Members only. Travel, entertainment, what's on? This is The Ticket on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to The Ticket. We're too busy chatting about this being the last ever Radio Book Club.
The Radio Book Club. Members only.
We're chatting about podcasts. We have got one for you coming up, but not before a good book for the kids next time you're traveling. Here's a good way to get them reading. Bring them a book that they can read on the plane, or when you get on holiday, that they can read whilst you're out on a sun lounger. I used to be encouraged to do that, to read while sunbathing. It's a great place to read, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Or round the pool.
Yeah, but it'll get wet.
I'm that's okay.
To bring my book.
No, that's okay. There's nothing better than a book that's been wet in the pool and then dried by the sun. Like, it's got such a holiday feel about it when you stick it back in your suitcase. It's great. What are you suggesting for the little ones this week then?
I've got a book called Out, Out, Away From Here by Rachel Woodward. And it's a really good book for children about emotional intelligence because emotions can be overwhelming, I mean, for adults, but especially for children, right? This book is for ages 4 to 8, and it's really colorful. It's got watercolors and really nice illustrations.
Little girl on the front looks like me.
Yeah, that's true. She's got red, but you smile more than her.
I do?
She looks a little bit grumpy.
Oh.
The narrator confides in the reader, and she says, "Some days I feel smiling ear to ear, glad. Some days I feel mad sad, but on those mad sad noisy days, I like to go out, out, away from here." And in the book, there's a little baby, so a new sibling maybe, and then the parents were struggling a little bit in managing whatever it is, maybe the family or something else, and then they're arguing a little bit, and the little girl has all these emotions, and she doesn't know how to deal with them, and as the parents are fighting, she goes into her room and she just starts to imagine, goes into her imaginations, and she goes somewhere very happy and colorful. But when she comes back, everything is calm. You know, dinner is served, both parents are there, everybody's smiling. So it's sort of to say to kids, you know, it happens sometimes, but it's okay to go away, think happy thoughts, come back, it'll be okay. And, you know, how to deal with all sorts of imagine. So, you know, you don't expect everything to be perfect all the time.
That's really important.
Yeah.
What age group is this for?
4 to 8. It's a picture book. Not a lot of words, but the idea behind this is quite important.
That reminds me of that. Was it a Pixar movie or a Disney movie where it was all about sort of that expectation that you should be happy all the time as a child? And the character experiences one sad emotion, and it's a crisis.
Toy Story, when Penguin gets wheezy.
No, what is it called? It's the one Inside Out or something like that.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Just the idea of, you know, kids always having to be happy. But yeah. Of course, it's important for them to understand and learn how to deal with some of those other emotions.
Yeah, and also, like, it's important to not raise your kids in a bubble all the time, and that, you know, not don't fight in front of them, don't say anything in front of them, you know, this and that. And then they go into the real world and they're like, what is this? Because they grow up very sheltered. But at the same time, you know, don't unleash all in front of kids as well, because those things have effects long term.
There's not a book for that.
No.
Not this one anyway.
No.
So Out, Out, Away From Here by Rachel Woodward. That book for the kids traveling, just the little ones under 8 years old, between 4 and 8. So moving on to a podcast then, for those times when your hands are busy and you just want to potter around and listen to something good.
Yeah, I've been wanting to talk about this podcast for 3 weeks, but we always run out of time.
I know. We just got time today. It's good.
I know. So here it is. So the podcast is called The Constant, A History of Getting Things Wrong, hosted by Mark Chrysler. And the reason why I chose it is because we need to be reminded how human beings didn't always have the answers that we have today. And actually, oftentimes we believe things to be 100% true and they turned out to be false. You know, things like the earth is flat, for example, you know, there was no doubt about that. And I like that because it makes you think, well, you know, what else am I sure about right now? And how can I be open to possibilities? Because, you know, just because it's scientifically proven based on, you know, what we have right now doesn't mean that in the future it could be something else.
Just like avocados are the best thing on toast, you don't know until they find the next thing.
That's true, right? There's always something different. And the podcast says interesting things, like, for example, Europeans apparently many years ago used to believe that sheep grew from Mongolian trees. Or that you know, there's inventions that go wrong, things like in the Las Vegas hotel, you know, the roof accidentally shoots heat rays at people by the pool and things like that. So people, you know, you can hire the best minds to do certain things, but things can always go wrong.
Does it really shoot heat waves at people at the
pool? Yeah, apparently. I think they've changed it now. Whoa. But it did for a little while. And
what a shocker.
Yeah, so it's a good podcast about things like that, about people getting things wrong. And
we grabbed a snippet of this. Mm-hmm. Which one did you go for? Oh, did Mark grab this?
I think Mark,
because it was that long ago.
Yeah.
Right, let's see. It says on here, do good carefully. Let's take a listen.
We're flying high with the 58th Airborne Squadron of the Royal Air Force in a Blackburn Beverly transport plane. Well, not too high, because we've got some cargo to drop. It's the early 1950s, and we're on a special airdrop over the Sarawak region of the island of Borneo. The Dayak people have a problem, and the RAF is carrying the solution. When we get above the drop zone, the giant clamshell doors on the back of the plane open, and out goes the payload. Not bombs, not food, not even tools or supplies. As the long boxes slide out the back, you might even be able to hear the hull as it falls. Cats. Dozens, maybe even hundreds of cats. Don't worry, they're equipped with parachutes. And after they land safely, the boxes open up, and the cats are free to go about their feline lives in the fields, forests, and particularly the houses of Borneo.
Why?
I'm gripped.
Me too.
Can we blame that one on Mark?
We can. Well, why would you be dropping cats off in Borneo?
I think Mark, because of my fear of cats, wanted to like bring this in the last minute of our final show.
That was the weirdest clip ever.
I need to know. I'm going to look it up after this.
Me too. The Constant. And that was doing good carefully. Wow.
I guess they're trying to release cats into the jungle so they can live a more natural...
No, I'm going to guess they had a problem with mice.
Yeah, something like that.
Just really weird.
Why did they have to be, parachuted out?
Couldn't they just land and let them out? It's very bizarre. Anyway, you'll have to listen to the rest of the podcast to understand.
Can I recommend a different episode?
You can.
So there's a really good episode about how human beings actually didn't even know where babies came from until only 1 year before the telephone was invented.
No.
What?
Yes, like really, really where they came from.
That's amazing.
That's an interesting episode. Listen to that. Forget the cats and parachute episode.
I still don't know where babies come from. Aklam, it has been fantastic working with you. You are a little ray of sunshine. Thank you so much.
As are you. Thanks and good luck with everything, Steph.
And I'm sure you'll be back on the radio very soon. See you later.
See you.
Bye.
Radio Book Club.
And we are out of here. We'll be back tomorrow, yeah?
Absolutely.
You definitely coming back?
Yeah.
Super duper.
This is The Ticket.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8. There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.